Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Dave Licken. Welcome to Licken on Lending. It is Monday, November 16th, and we are excited to bring you this program each and every week. The purpose of this program, and again, is to take a look at everything that's going on in the industry, digest it, and bring you the information in a meaningful way and a concise way so that you can make your decisions on how you're going to go about the industry this next week. So stay tuned. By the way, you can go to Blog Talk Radio, download any of the previous programs by just logging into Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalkradio.com. In the search box, put Licken on Lending, L-Y-K-K-E-N, on Lending. And it'll take you to that segment of the website that has all our pre-recorded programs. I welcome you to download and listen to it. And the reason I think it's a great idea, and we're getting a lot of feedback, a lot of people are doing that, is because there's such a wealth of money, so much information, a wealth of information that we try to cover, and we cover it rather rapidly. And so sometimes the only way you can get everything is by going back and listening to the program on an iPod or on your computer, either way, however you want to do it. We welcome you and to download the previous programs. Today, I am at the Distressed Servicing Conference in Austin, Texas, and I will not be on the program live. So these comments are on a pre-recorded and are being played, and then we will get live into the rest of the program. Now, Joe Farr and Alice Alvey are live, and the comments, their comments that you're about ready to hear are live. And after I get done with my comments and Joe gets done with the rate segment, Alice Alvey is going to take over as the hostess, and the hostess with the mostest. So Alice, thank you so much for doing that for us, for me specifically, and we appreciate that. Joe, there's a lot going on in the world of interest rates, as they are every week. We appreciate you bringing your thoughts and perspective to the market. And without further ado, let's let you take it away and give us an update on rates. Joe?
Yeah, you know, Alice Day was pretty prophetic. He identified things were going on today, and they sure are. You know, when I sent you my notes earlier today, I mentioned that the market was flat. Well, since that time, we've seen a nice little jump up in MBS prices, which means, lower rates, higher prices are good. It means lower rates. We're now up 6/32 on the day. And, I can give you a little insight. It seems to be associated with Bernanke. Fed Chairman Bernanke is speaking, and there's been some concern in the market about the declining value of the dollar, and one of the ways to shore up the dollar is to increase interest rates, short-term interest rates. And so, you know, that has been a concern. But in the speech that Bernanke is giving right now, there's been some reiteration of what was said last week or at the last Fed meeting, which is they're going to focus on jobs and inflation, which is sort of their mandate. And so I guess the market has liked what they have heard from Bernanke so far today, and the reaction has been okay.
Well, that sounds great, Joe. Hello, everyone, and thank you for jumping right into that, Joe, as we're Dave is not with us today, and so you're going to listen to questions from me today. And
also
on the call today, we'll have with us Tony Gallegos, formerly of Wells Fargo, who's now working with Mortgage U on various consulting projects. So you'll hear both of us firing some questions at you today, Joe, especially.
Ask the questions I can answer, and we'll be good.
That's right. Well, no, we like to keep you on your toes, too. But So how long, is there anything else in the speech that we can expect today may have an impact on rates?
Well, it's been going out, and, they released the notes before the speech, and the reaction to the interpretation of his notes was not so much as the reaction to his actual speech. So far, so good. Up 6 on the day, sort of the the prices were staying real close to where they ended last Friday for much of the morning. So we're up a good 6/32 so far on the day. And this morning, retail sales came out. Retail sales is always a big economic indicator for mortgage markets. And this morning, it came out where retail sales, including the impact of autos, was better than expected. But that's always pretty volatile. So that being removed, retail sales came in a little lower than expected. So it was a little mixed message today. But You know, one of the interesting things we've noticed over the last week or so, Alice, is that we've seen a very nice rally in the Dow. At the same time, we've seen a very nice rally in MBS prices. Over since the last Fed meeting, which the minutes were released on on November 3rd, the Dow is up 600 points. That's almost 6%.
I know, that's great. I'm happy about where my investments are going.
Yeah, I know. Everyone's feeling a little better maybe. But usually when we've seen in the past, we've seen the Dow improve. We've seen it improve at the cost of the MBS market or the Treasuries.
Right.
And so far since November 3rd, that same time period, MBS prices are up for the 4.5% mortgage-backed security. They're up a full point.
So is that
then.
Just an anomaly in the market or something driving that right now?
Well, what's driving it is that there's a large supply of money in the marketplace, so there's a lot of money to be invested. And there, in the Fed's comments at the November 3rd meeting were that would led people to understand that they do not believe that inflation is a concern in the near term and that there will be no Fed rate hikes in the near term. The jobs are weak, as we've all read and we know about. And so from an investor's perspective, borrowing short and putting it into more risky assets, usually longer-term assets like the stock market or MBS market, may generate a nice little spread for a while. And their concern will be, if I borrow short and lend long, the old mismatch there, that if I'm going to have my short end rates raised anytime soon, that makes me less likely to invest it. And so it seems to be that they're saying that it's not going to be likely to see that short end rate raised.
I know everyone's going to be watching retail sales as that holiday season starts to just become even closer and closer.
That's right.
So, maybe we can, if those are a little lower than expected, then you won't see prices rise, I guess.
That's right. Also,
hey,
during the same, oh, yes. Yeah, Tony?
I'm sorry. Joe, I know that it's apparent there's a lot of short-term optimism right now for the market. But one of the questions that I get repeatedly, and I know that, Allison, you do too, is with all this money being pumped into the economy, really, in essence, what's happening is they're utilizing both Keynesian and monetary policy. So a lot of money is being put into the economy. What are the long-term ramifications of this, and what do you see that does to interest rates and inflation? Because I know short-term there's not a lot of concern, but long-term, what is your perspective on that?
Well, certainly long-term, Tony, that there's got to be a rise in rates as inflationary pressures pick up. There is so much money in the economy, and certainly when people feel better about spending, we're going to see pressure on prices. We're going to see inflation pick up. There appears to be some confidence in the Fed's ability to potentially help control that, but the way they're going to control inflationary pressure is by raising rates. So it will come. It's just a matter of when, and right now it's an expectation that it's further out. Seems to be it's not going to happen real soon. One of the other consequences, particularly to the mortgage market, and we've talked about this in the past, inflation or rising rates can come from a number of things. One thing is inflation, and that doesn't appear to be a concern in the near term. But the other is supply and demand. And much of the demand to buy the investments that mortgage loans that are being made today wind up in, those being mortgage-backed securities, is coming from the federal government. It is buying a substantial percentage of all that gets closed and all that gets originated and sold today. And that's part of the $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities that they have announced will be purchased. And this week, we just went over the $1 trillion amount, and so we have $250 billion left to buy over the next 19 weeks. And so far as the market knows, the Fed's going to stop at the end of March 31st.
Yeah, so we're all kind of waiting till after the holidays, right? It's like, let's see what starts to happen in the wind down in the first part of the year.
Let's hope it continues to be a Merry Christmas, right?
Right, right. Yeah, maybe they're just trying to keep us happy for now, and then we'll start finding out more of the details after the first of the year. Any other questions? For those of you who heard the new voice on our program today, that is Tony Gallegos. Tony joins us from having been at Wells Fargo, and he has a very extensive bio here in the mortgage industry. He served in the capacity of area sales manager, national government sales production manager, and in his final position as a VP in national retail government production. So Tony's going to be joining our discussion throughout the day, as well as we'll be talking more about the hot topics having to do with FHA and risk later in the program. But Joe, just to kind of finish up this segment, what do you expect? What's going on in the market this week? Let everybody know what they should be watching for the rest of this week.
Well, given the Fed's position on inflation, we can expect that we hope that they're right. Well, the market's certainly counting on them to be right. But this week we're going to see both CPI, that's Consumer Price Index, and the Producer Price Index will be announced. And it would be a big shock to the market if those numbers were to come in much higher than expected. If they were to, then I think we could see a negative reaction in this nice little 7 days in a row rally may end. Producer prices come out tomorrow, and consumer prices come out on Wednesday. So keep your eyes on those two things. They're both early in the morning announcements. I think they're 8:30 Eastern time. And, it could be market moving to the downside, meaning it could have, in my mind, it could have a more negative impact on MBS prices and on mortgage rates than positive, because everyone kind of assumes that those are going to be fairly tame. Also this week, and to a lesser extent, a degree of importance, industrial production comes out tomorrow, and housing starts on Wednesday, and the Philadelphia Fed Manufacturing Index comes out on Thursday. So really the big days this week are tomorrow and Wednesday.
All right. Well, we'll watch those closely, and now we all know what to do. So everybody, hopefully you're signed up with MBS Quote Line and following Joe's words of wisdom and advice that go on every day throughout the day to help you with your pipelines. Well, thank you, Joe. That was great. We'll be back in just a minute with Lickin' on Lending.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS QuoteLine delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock-float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect. And know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS QuoteLine, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS QuoteLine today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Well, welcome back, everyone. Dave is not with us today as he is speaking at an event today, and this is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave today. And, you know, now is my normal segment to jump in and give you the quick legislative update. And, you know, we have such a long list now of legislation to monitor. I want to just start with the things that have actually changed in the last week. So, first of all, I think all over the news wires, people are becoming aware that Senator Dodd released the financial reform bill. So this is essentially the Senate version of trying to come up with who is going to be the new regulator of mortgage lending, whether it's a bank, a credit union, lender, broker. Who's going to be this oversight agency that we need, that Congress thinks that we need, and in some respects as an industry we do too. So if you take a look, Senator Dodd's bill doesn't actually have a number yet. It's called the Financial Institutions Regulatory Administration that he's looking to try and create. The bill would also create a new independent agency for financial stability. This would really oversee the systemic risk issues concerning any entity that might be too big to fail. And it has a lot of pieces within it that are similar to the House bill before all the amendments were added. So now we're dealing with, we have the Senate bill, we have our House versions, we also have House Bill 1728. So essentially right now, three different pieces of legislation that are trying to come up with this single, is it the Consumer Financial Protection Agency that would regulate the industry. One of the big pieces we're watching within this bill is that this particular version puts a high level of responsibility on those who are selling securities. And this one puts in that it should be not less than 10% of the credit risk should be retained by the entity. We'll be talking in our Hot Topics about how that's done and what are some of the challenges with that. Secondly on the list is the FDIC adopted some final rules for the SAFE Act amendments. We've all been waiting for this to see definitely would the banks be subject to certain aspects of the SAFE Act. So yes, this is done. Those of you who are employed by a bank, if you're acting as a loan originator, you would be responsible for having to get registered, getting a background check. And then the one exemption in this is if you originate five or fewer residential loans during a 12-month period, then you would be exempt from having to be registered. So I haven't read all 102 pages yet. We'll make sure we double check that, make sure there aren't any other surprises in that, but that one we were expecting. The rest of the bills that we're watching for you, as I mentioned, 1728, the Mortgage Reform and Anti-Predatory Lending Act, is really the version as an industry for housing reform that has the most sense in it for the lender risk, the lender credit risk aspect of what would lenders have to retain. Because this particular one says lenders would be responsible for carrying or maintaining 5% interest in the loan, but it describes that that would only apply to subprime type products. And so certainly something a little easier to work with in a compromise situation. We're still watching also the House Bill 3706 that would require the FHA to have a minimum down payment of 5% as opposed to the 3.5% we're watching now. We do have that loan limits passed, so we are good to go in 2010 with our new higher loan limits. And, of course, the home buyer tax credit, that piece was passed, and within it we all got a little bit of a window that sales after November 6th, so effective with purchase contracts on November 7th, we actually get an increase of income limits to $125,000 for single taxpayers and $225,000 for married couples filing jointly. So that was great that we got a little bit of an income increase for those who may qualify immediately before the deadline. And then the income limits increase again for January 1st, 2009 through November 6th. Those were $75,000. So we have a nice increase that went into effect very quickly here. And so that's the quick down and dirty of the update on the legislative front for today. And we will go ahead and take a break. We'll be right back after this.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals
providing classroom and web-based delivery
and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lincoln on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's David Lincoln.
Hello, everyone. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave today. And I just want to start this segment off by talking about the RESPA reform. HUD announced that they're going to have this four-month period of restraint for enforcing the new RESPA rule. And so, you know, okay, great, it's still effective January 1st, 2010. I still have to try and get everything in line. They're just essentially saying that I'm not going to start writing you up immediately on January 2nd. And so I thought this would be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the hot items that are still out there about this RESPA reform. And I'd like Tony and Joe to join in the discussion here. And I wanted to kind of start out with some of the questions that I see that are still outstanding for the customers where we're doing training. And I think some of the big things are still, how do I show my income and the fees on what is now becoming, you know, the infamous Block 1 and Block 2 on Page 2 of the Good Faith Estimate. As companies are starting to put together actual examples of trying to use this form, they're starting to realize this is a challenge. I've got a lot of lump sum fees showing up as my origination charge, and this is going to look like a pretty big number for some customers on that line. So I just wanted to kind of start, Tony. I know that you've been involved in the RESPA as well, and so I wanted to get kind of your thoughts and takes on the fees that they're being seen on the good faith estimate in the new form.
Right. You know, Alice, and I know this is a big concern with talking to officials within HUD about that block number one or box number one, because they are seeing this, and what I'm hearing from comments, especially from a lot of mortgage brokers, are that that's a big fee that that can dissuade a lot of borrowers from going through the broker channel. And this is, again, as I said, a big concern, and this is something they're going to be addressing and trying to explain on what this means. I think the biggest component to really understand with this form was made for consumer protection, and it wasn't really so much made for the industry. So that's something that we have to really understand, and really that's just the way it's going to be. But the key component to this is understanding that this now has to be filled out appropriately. And box number one, that has to encompass all the fees that the broker is going to charge or make. And it's kind of almost like, while it's a consumer protection form, it's almost like a, I hate to say this, it's almost like a time card for a person, because you have to state, or a broker has to state exactly what they're going to make, and that has to be encompassed there. And then you can have breakdowns throughout the different form, but that has to encompass everything that a broker or a correspondent is going to make on it. I think that's the biggest thing that really the mortgage community has to really understand. And I know that you've had a lot of questions on that too, Alice.
Well, and I think, you know, in the old good faith, I should say in today's good faith estimate, the yield spread was off to the side. You know, if the customer brought it up, there were some loan officers that would explain it, some that wouldn't. I mean, some people didn't explain it well. And so the idea that now absolutely everything has to go in this block to offset any credit. So if in block two, as a broker, for example, or even if I'm a lender brokering a loan, if I'm earning, just for argument's sake, $1,000 in yield on the back end from the lender, the wholesaler paying me, then essentially in block one, I've got to have that same amount of fee up in block one in order to be able to have that paid back to me, because the way that block one and two work together to total block A for what is the actual income on the loan.
Right, right. So. And I think the key important component on this is, and this is something you have to be able to clearly articulate to the customer, these are the fees. However, as you're going in block number two, there's yield spread premium involved with this, so you minus that out of it. And this is going to number A, where it says your adjusted origination charges. This is the bottom line of what it's going to be. And you have to be able to fully express it, saying these are the charges. This is everything. However, this is what we minus out from a lender perspective. So, again, the key critical component that I would really stress to originators is how to articulate this, and then really stress to the borrowers. Really, block number A is the important thing that they look at.
And, you know, one of the things I've noticed about many of the seminars, you know, I think every day in my email box I get an announcement for about, you know, three or four RESPA seminars that are going on right now. You can participate in a webinar an hour now, it seems. Many of them are geared towards the compliance compliance side. We are putting together one that will talk to exactly what you're describing, the idea of, as a salesperson, I've got to learn how to talk again. I like the analogy that you gave, that this is like a time card. This is saying to the customer, this is what I'm going to make, and you better get it right, because it now has to be valid for 10 days.
Alice, is there a likelihood that people will generate more premium pricing so that there'll be a bigger number that seems to be offsetting the fees?
You know, I haven't really seen that companies are going to lean that way. When you talk to people who are faced with having to fill this in, and we've done a lot of that, we have more sessions coming up, you have a mixed set of emotions depending on the type of company. Some are saying, well, that's it, I'm just going to figure out par pricing. Others are saying, well, I'll just simply up the fees, right? If I'm getting $1,000 on the back, I'll just simply show a broker fee of the same amount on the front in line one to offset that income and basically make it zero out so that the customer isn't paying it. But, you know, so I think companies are still trying to do all those line-by-line comparisons to say, here's how my life is today. Here under this new GFE, it would work, and then they're going to have to come up with their strategies for coping with it. Tony, have you seen anything with people trying to compare numbers on this yet?
No, but, you know, that is an interesting thought, and I went to a HUD meeting on this last Monday, and that was one of the points that somebody brought up, so that is something that they also are looking at, because it could be interesting where somebody could be trying to really, let's say, up the amount of yield spread premium and then just kind of floating it to a certain example. So there were some concerns that there would be some, for lack of a better term, manipulation of that.
Well, and I think one of the things that's my concern right now, and we're still working with the numbers, is to just try and identify what's the impact to different price ranges for borrowers. You know, does this mean financing costs are going to go up for lower loan amounts? Does it mean financing costs, how does it impact financing costs between loan amount ranges and there are obviously some subsequently income ranges? So I think there's some challenges that companies really just are heads up today is really make sure that you spend some time dissecting how your company is going to fill this in. Literally taking, here's my good faith today, and lining it up with the new one to be able to say, these fees are going to now have to go into this box. Now, Tony, any other news on, you know, how much leeway do you really think I have if I'm a company that can't get this quite started on January 1st, you know? I know we've been talking about the recommendations that we would make for companies as this moves forward.
Okay, well, you know what, you bring up an interesting question, and again, there is that grace period where they're not going to start enforcing it. However, the intent of this was that, and this is the feedback that HUD received from the industry, is that they could not make their systemic changes within their legacy system. So that's one of the reasons that HUD is really not going to enforce this, and they have a grace period. However, if they do get documentation or it somehow showed that they're just ignoring this and not enhancing this, and it wasn't because of their system issues, this is something that HUD still could enforce. So, again, it's mainly they're not enforcing this because of systemic issues within getting their systems upgraded. So that's a great question, and that's one of the things that HUD is going to look for if they get a loan and they do an audit on it. Was it just ignored because they were in the grace period, or was it because of systemic problems within their legacy systems?
Oh, I think that's a huge point to make sure that customers are aware of, because some people will just read, oh, I got a 120-day extension, and mm-hmm. then they may not be doing anything about it and think that they just have a new implementation date, and that's clearly not the case. I think it's interesting that they phrased it this way as a restraint so that customers or people in the industry know this is not an extension. This is, and like you said, you better be able to prove if you're not following it as soon as possible after January 1st.
You know, Alice, you're bringing up a very important point, especially the way that they phrased it, because they did want to leave a lot of leeway. And sometimes, and not sometimes, many times, people take that you know, literally the way it is. But as you know, Alice, on the back end, what is typically or a lot of times put out in press or on paper and the way it's enforced on the back end can be two different things. Because
right.
In what
did
they
somebody
say,
tell the audit department? The, yeah.
Yes. You know, and we're kind of going to the risk component. And I know we're jumping to this, but a classic example of this, many times you hear, well, these are not HUD guidelines. Why do the lenders have credit overlays on? Because a back end pressure by HUD to put these on. So we
yeah.
can get to that later. But what happens on the back end and what they actually put out many times can be two different things.
I would suggest that would be true for this 4-month moratorium. I don't know if you're delivering loans to one of the big correspondents, if they're going to be as generous with their time.
Oh, that's exactly. A huge point. Some of them, you know, I think you may find differences, right? Certainly with Wells, who was saying don't give an extension, and so you better watch who you're delivering to.
That's exactly it, and I do believe that Wells is ready for this. So this is not something that's just going to be taken broadly, you know, across the band. And I know that we were talking, and I believe it is Wells Fargo, that one of the things they are going to be, for lack of a better term, watching for that box number one is filled out appropriately, but not so much, I would say, for the broker, but to make sure that their fees have been taken care of in that box. So.
Right. Well, and also in the legislative update was this issue of the financial reform bill. So, Joe, I know you've had some good comments and questions about this. Anything you'd like to interject about what we're facing with the Consumer Financial Protection Agency and this new attempt at financial reform bill from Senator Dodd?
Well, it struck me as we were just having that conversation that the result of the new GFE may be that borrowers pay more fees. And will the result of the Consumer Financial Protection Act be that consumers are protected more or spending more? I mean, it just seems difficult that the result is going to benefit the consumer in many of these cases.
Well, we still haven't figured out how they anticipate a lender's going to retain risk. So,
yeah, that is a
yeah.
Is it going to be that you can only sell 90% of the loan you make, or is it that you have to guarantee 10% of any loss on the loan? Have you heard anyone sort of communicate that?
Well, the only thing I've heard is we had John Corson from the Mortgage Bankers Association speaking at the Michigan Mortgage Lenders event last week, and John Corson stated that no one really has come up with a plan on how exactly that's going to be done. That hasn't been articulated in any kind of reasonable detail for people to know what exactly does that mean. What do they have in mind when they just say, you know, that you're going to have to retain 10% of the credit risk? Is that just simply on a balance sheet? Is that just simply in the event of repurchase or non-performance? How does that work?
Is it the top 10% or is it 10% of the loss?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know what?
I was just going to say, and what do you do with a loan that's sold multiple times?
Right. And the other interesting component of this, and I haven't heard much discussion on it, and Joe, you may have some insight into this, is typically once they figure that out, could this increase the pricing that lenders are going to be offering because they have to increase their internal tax rate to cover for these losses or for any type, you know, to cover that 10% in addition to their normal tax that they put on it?
No question that somebody that's got to retain that risk, certainly if they had to keep 10% of the asset on their books, that would require more capital. And even if they have to retain 10% of the risk of that loan, that's still going to require more capital because you're going to have to hold reserves. And things are measured in return on capital. So right now, what really is a fee-generating process, meaning people are making a loan and they're selling the loan and subject to just normal reps and warranties. Once they've sold the loan, they're pretty much through their process. Now they're going to have to retain capital and they're going to have to charge more in order to offset that additional capital required.
Well, I'm interested in a loan that's been sold, say, or been touched by 3-4 lenders now. So you've got it. 3 companies have 10% interest, and that bulk of transactions goes up for sale in a servicing sale. You know, how do you value that you have hit-and-miss loan buckets that are now have varying degrees of other parties with financial responsibility?
And we won't even go into tranches.
Right. Well, it sounds like people can have a field day with that one, huh?
It could be that it's kind of like selling mineral rights on property, right, where you negotiate with or without minerals.
There you go, yeah.
Well, I'll say you this, but I'll keep the 10%, or I'll say this, no, you take the 10%.
Right, yeah. Well, all remains to be seen. So thank you both for your input on that. It is time to take another quick break. We'll be right back with Lincoln on Lending.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
Whether you need a new warehouse line or making the transition from broker to banker, are interested in mergers and acquisitions,
or anything in between, Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging, financial and accounting services, or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact a Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
Welcome back, everyone, to Lickin' on Lending. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave again. And in this segment, we're going to talk about our hot topic, which is going to be focused this time on two things. We're going to talk about credit risk. People have been using the terminology, is it back to the fundamentals or back to the future? And being an old-time underwriter from the early 80s, I can tell you I feel like a lot of my skills are new and different from underwriting back from those days. But also, we also want to spend some time after that segment to talk about HUD changes in lender and mini EAGLE approvals. So let's get started with our first topic on credit risk and the idea of back to fundamentals. What does it actually mean? You know, we've got a lot of times we've talked about different underwriting risks and what makes sense. And I know I had a customer recently who was trying to get a loan, and the borrower, they had assets 3 or 4 times the amount of the loan, but the borrower was newly retired, didn't have a lot of interest income built up, didn't have the income component to qualify, but certainly a great loan, great credit score. Yet in today's new world, have we gotten so conservative that this person can't get a loan? So, Tony, I know that you have been doing a lot of research on this front, and within Mortgage U, we're going to be getting involved a lot with lenders on identifying their risk portfolios. So why don't we talk a little bit about what does back to fundamentals actually mean? What are the fundamentals and what really is meaningful in identifying if a loan can perform?
Well, Alice, you brought up a really good term, and you and I were laughing about it, but it's not really a funny story, but it's you know, back to the future. But I think one of the best places to start this portion of the show is in 1994, I remember I went to a meeting in which the head of technology for Fannie Mae came and gave a speech to some of the mortgage bankers in Colorado. And in essence, his speech said, cutting it down briefly, is, our technology is getting so good that in, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 years, we're going to be able to sit monkeys in a seat. And when you input this critical data into the LOS system, and it's going to be able to say, it's going to be able to assess risk. So it's going to do the layered risk analysis. So one of the best things that happened to the mortgage industry were these LOS systems.
And that person was wrong.
Yes. Well, it's been one of the best things, but it's also been one of the worst things because it did allow for automation. We're able to handle a much larger volume. But what's happened now, and you well know this, is it's really diminished the skills within the mortgage banking community, because I remember when I was an originator, I had a processor sitting next to me and many times even an underwriter. And the processors took great pride in submitting a loan with no conditions. And that's really not the case anymore, and it's not because the personnel within the fulfillment sites or within our industry are not as smart or whatever. It's just that because of that assessment, we can put monkeys in the seat and let the LOS systems tell us what's a good loan and what's a bad loan. It's really hurt the skill level within the industry. So what's happening is the industry is realizing this, and we've seen it in the performance, because many of these loans that are performing poorly were not maybe – looking at the numbers, if they would have been figured out appropriately, they would be performing. But many times, personnel do not know how to or understand how to appropriately calculate income or look at an appraisal, many other types of things. So what's happening is it's going back to the future again, getting and solidifying your fulfillment teams and your sales force in solid practical, fundamental underwriting principles and understanding layered risk.
Well, it's interesting. We were just going through that with a customer last week in a training class, and they really, you know, like you, to your point, they were trained to respond to feedback, and a lot of companies did originate underwrite process in order to get it through the automation system and really just validate. And they're finding they all have to go back to manual underwriting of all components. It still doesn't change that approve eligible piece, though. How do you see that fitting in? You know, we've got more lenders afraid to take a refer in an FHA, for example. You know, so does going back to fundamentals mean that maybe the lenders, the big lenders, will get more comfortable with accepting refers as they understand real risk?
Well, you know what, you're asking a very interesting component. And when I tell people this, their eyes widen. When I was at Wells, one of the things that I had to be heavily involved with was many of the audits directly with HUD and HUD-IG and other types of HUD neighborhood watch issues. And to tell you the truth, I would much rather defend a decision that was a referred transaction than one that was an approve accept through total scorecard. And the reason is if any of the figures were off, you can't go, well, look at here, this, this, and this. They go, yeah, but you can't run this through the decision engine again, and it may come back as a non-approved. However, as a referred transaction, if the underwriter that underwrote this, let's say, referred transaction, they approved the loan, and they clearly articulated why they did it, here's the reason for it, they identified the layered risk, here's the offsets, that you can still defend that much easier in an audit than you can an accept type of transaction, because if anything's off on that, other than what the variances they allow, then it's an indemnification for the lender. So you bring up a very good point, and it's going back to the fundamentals, understanding layered risk, identifying them, what makes sense, and why, and here's and why it makes sense, and documenting it accordingly.
Well, and I think the challenge is we're not seeing the lenders react that way. As a matter of fact, it's almost coming to, you know, it's a strange combination of balancing risks. So I have approved eligibles that can't be taken by some lenders if the DTI is over 50%, if the debt ratio is over 50%. And yet they won't take refers where the debt ratio is in line. It's just a matter of maybe some credit issues that need to be manually assessed. I just find that interesting because I think making a loan affordable is the number one way to make it a performing loan.
Exactly. And, Alice, I think it's going back to what we were talking about. I would say, and this is unscientific, but I would say 80% of the people in our industry were not around 20 years ago. And in many instances, they're the ones that are making these type of guidelines of what's going on, and they don't really truly understand it. So over the next few years, we are going to be going through a re-education. And also, this is what, in my opinion, happened within the investment banking circles that build these financial models that allowed for a lot of these subprime type loans. Very intelligent people, but they had not been around, let's say, during the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and saw that the market actually does go down. So they had a short memory or no memory at all. So I think it's systemic amongst the industry, and we've seen it where any time where they retract, they get too tight, but the market will adjust, and it will go back, you know, more into common sense and what makes sense. And going back to your example of somebody who was newly retired but had substantial reserves, that's something that should happen. But again, in these tight times, especially during times of regulation where the regulators are looking heavily, they're going to contract and be very conservative. And they're being too conservative right now.
Yeah. Well, let's move. That's a great way to sum up that topic. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit more about HUD changes in the lender and the Mini Eagle approval. Joe, I know you were interested in this subject very much. Well, you're interested in all the subjects as well, but we didn't give you a chance to get a word in edgewise on that last beat. So you're certainly welcome to jump in anytime on the credit risk.
my comment would have been in that credit risk question is we'll swing back to where we – to not where we were, but certainly – closer to, you know, rational underwriting decisions, so long as there's competition.
Right.
And right now there's such a few number of people who are not overly enthused about buying, being the biggest like they were, or buying every deal they can so that somebody else isn't getting those deals. So, I think that leads into this next subject is competition and who's the one in charge, who are the ones in charge anyway?
Well, Well, when you try to do things by large mass numbers and companies want to use computers to assess risk or, you know, like in the secondary side, assess this number of loans in this portfolio have this amount of risk, that's a different ball game. When you get a chance to look at the ability to, here's a group of loans and I know exactly what's in them at a lender, a mid-sized lender level, that actually can be better production, better quality loans because I have a good handle on that pipeline. We don't want to see that segment of the market disappear. We want to see that mid-level lender who really has their feet on the ground to be able to still thrive in this industry.
You know, Alice, you're bringing up a very important component, and it's going back into the mini eagle and the amount of competition that's there, and then a lot of the mega lenders and what is too big to fail and getting into that. But competition is very important in this industry. While we're going to have more regulation, it has to be good regulation and making sure that it's good for the consumer. And again, that goes back to good type of competition. And I think it also circles back into Joe's discussion earlier about, who can get approved, just the whole process in secondary marketing, the federal government buying mortgage-backed securities, and is that keeping the jumbo market from being, from thriving or even being there? So, I think it all ties together, and can we create an environment that there's good competition and it creates the best rates and marketplace for the consumers?
Well, I'll segue into that whole mini eagle approval. So, Tony, if you want to kind of give us an update on that, we should be expecting something in writing on that very soon, I understand, in terms of doing away with mini eagles?
Right, and I did speak to some of the officials within HUD this weekend and today, and they have put together and signed off on the way that the broker approval process is going to work for FHA loans. One of the things that I can say, based upon the feedback that I had received, is, and I get a lot of questions on this, should I continue to get my audited financial? And the question is yes, because both from the lenders and what I've heard from HUD, most lenders are going to continue with the same type of process. It's going to be an evolving type of process, but HUD should be putting out some written guidance on what this process should be shortly. It's already been signed off. They're just waiting for it to go through the whole approval process.
I have a lot of questions on that. You know, if I'm a wholesaler and I now become responsible for all the brokers all on my own, the easiest thing for me to say, at least procedurally, or for implementing a procedure on paper, is to say, sure, I'll just require all of you to keep doing the same thing you had to do with FHA, but that's a lot of staff and a lot of systems I'm going to have to set up in order to do that.
Right, and Alice, again, my feeling is when this comes out and when the guidance is provided to the lenders, I believe that based upon the feedback that I'm receiving, that they're going to continue with the same process. But I do believe eventually there is going to be some softening. But the key key component to this is a lender has good, strong quality process controls in place for their broker business. Because really when you look at these companies that had problems with their correspondent business, they didn't have good quality controls in place. And it makes a tremendous opportunity for a lender to go and capture a significant amount of market share if they have good quality controls in place. So to me, that's going to be the critical component, because the lenders that did are not having the issues. The ones that didn't did have the issues and they're out of business. So that's going to be the key critical component. There's going to be flexibility involved on what the lenders can do. But I believe it's going back to the basics and the fundamentals of having quality controls in place.
Joe, what are your thoughts on the lender and mini eagle approval changes?
Well, I'd have to ask the question of who would you rather have your company's future reside with? Is it HUD and their process for allowing people to continue to be in business, and they have a fairly a process that would include, if you get to this level, you get warnings. If you get to this level, you could be cut off. Or would you rather have one of the big correspondents have the fate of your company's existence in their hands? It seems like we're moving to the latter. And, personally, I don't know which one I'd rather have.
So the idea that there may not be the same due process.
Right. I mean, it sounds like HUD saying, hey, we'll buy your loans as long as you sell them through somebody, and that somebody is going to be the one that can allow you to continue in business or not.
Well, and I know you can get a wide range of opinions from, you know, companies who carry a mini eagle, because there's all different types of entities. It's not just mortgage brokers. There's certainly supervised lenders that have mini eagles. And that was really their entry into business. And it kind of gave you some clout to say, hey, I have my own FHA approval. So I can see where a lot of companies might be really happy that they now don't have to go down that road. But for a non-supervised lender who otherwise wouldn't have had to have very stringently audited financials, I guess we're saying continue to do that and continue your quality control. What do you see, you know, Tony, has there been any discussion from FHA on who's going to be responsible for the quality controls, the monthly QC audits going forward?
No, I haven't heard anything, and that's one of the things I have that I have on my notes to try to follow up on.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I think if I put my wholesaler hat on, having run that type of division before, say, do I want that responsibility? No, I'm going to contractually say that the brokers are going to still be responsible for having to do regular QC and having the full all-out implemented quality control plan. I mean, it doesn't sound like FHA is saying you don't have to do any of that anymore. They're going to just simply transfer responsibility for monitoring that it gets done.
Yeah, that's
wouldn't
my
you,
understanding.
Wouldn't you expect, Alice and Tony, that wholesalers being put in that position are going to look at who they get, you know, the 80-20 rule, right?
Right.
They get all 80% of their loans from 20% of their customers. So why would they go through the efforts on the 80% that only deliver 20% of loans? So it seems like they would most likely consolidate into their larger suppliers and go the effort on them. And so maybe a result is you wind up only having one correspondent that you're approved with in order to satisfy some volume needs?
I think that's a huge point, is that those of you who are looking at if you're someone who's sponsored by multiple entities and you've been playing the market with that, do you need to, during this window, perhaps look at aligning yourself and developing a good, strong relationship with one company who's going to get your business? Because you're right, it may make it more difficult to be sponsored or, you know, send loans to multiple places that may not know you.
Yeah, and the downside of that is that you lose your negotiating position on price.
Right. Well, I think we'll all be watching anxiously to see how the lender and mini eagle approval will evolve. It is supposed to be coming across as a ruling, so something that will have to be a proposed rule, and our understanding then certainly go through the comment period and get responses to that. And in that, initially, what we're anticipating is that it will be, Tony, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it'll be $1 million net worth, minimum net worth for the lenders, so that change, and simultaneously doing away with the status of what has up until now been considered a loan correspondent status, which meant it was the equivalent of mini eagle. In other words, you didn't have underwriting approval. Does that sound at least the initial premise, Tony, of what we should be expecting in the coming days?
That's exactly my understanding too, Alice.
Okay. And we'll watch for that as it comes through the systems, and you'll be sure to hear all the details about it. If it comes out this week, we'll be sure to include all those details in next week's program. David will be back, so you'll all get to hear his insight into all of the latest topics going on in the mortgage industry today. Thank you all for joining us today. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lincoln of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. On the web at www.mortgagebankingsolutions.com. Today's guests were Joe Farr and Scott Sanderson from MBS Quoteline, delivering live mortgage-backed security prices as trades happen, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U, your ultimate education and information resource. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.